or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Sarmana Mitra was born in India, came to the United States to study computer science and engineering, got her master's from MIT, started three Silicon Valley startups, and writes a column for Forbes magazine, and has written three books. Her new one is called Vision India 2020, in which she proposes 45 fictional businesses. It's kind of a blue-skying exercise she did for herself to kind of let her mind be unshackled by traditional thinking. She proposes these 45 fictional businesses that she thinks would be great ideas. She's been on the show before, and she was excellent, so I am bringing her back this morning to tell us about a few of her favorite 45. She and I, as we did last time, rather than just, you know, letting her talk, I won't let her do that. We will, however, as two equals, I like to think, kick them around, hopefully offering some lessons in entrepreneurship, how to start a business, and an interesting discussion in general. Sarmana Mitra, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marty. It's a delight to be back.
Good, good, good.
You're my favorite host.
I appreciate that. It's always good to suck up to the host. Very good. Well, let's get right to it. Your first idea that you came up with in the book is something you called MIT India, a way of preparing engineers in a smarter way. How would you, it keeps evolving. In fact, in our conversation in the coffee room, it kept evolving. So tell me the current version of what you consider MIT India as an entrepreneurial idea.
So the way I looked at India, I was looking at India's situation right now. Nobody in India who understands engineering at any deep level is going to go become a faculty. There's a very big faculty shortage because people are making so much money as practicing engineers from multinationals, from Indian multinationals. There's just, tremendous faculty shortage. People cannot find how to train engineers. So I was addressing in the MIT India project, I said that, well, MIT and other great American universities have put, as part of the Open Courseware project, this is you may not know about this, it's an open source initiative where top universities of the world are putting all their course material and lectures online, freely available to students and faculty around the world. So my MIT India project is kind of built on top of that resource that has already been built, so that people in India, deep into the heartland of India, where there are tons of engineering colleges, actually, where people can go into the heartland in India and train engineers using that course material. And the reason I was interested in using the MIT brand, and this could be a Stanford brand, it could be a Berkeley brand, but these global, major brands, educational brands, have brand power around which you can actually hire universities. That was one piece of the assumption. Another very important piece of the assumption is that the fees, the students who go to this program, this MIT India curriculum, are being sponsored by corporations. So the corporations who are trying to hire highly skilled engineers want to fund, let's say their hiring plan says they want, 100 or 500 really highly qualified engineers in the next year. They will fund, 2 years ahead of time, they will fund a chunk of engineers to go through this program. So those are some of the assumptions.
Three questions. Why would if it's open source and these courses are available free, why wouldn't I, if I am a student, why would I pay for, why wouldn't I just take these courses and simply say to my potential employer, I have taken these courses from the finest universities in the world, and now hire me. Why would I pay anything to do that?
Well, there needs to be testing and certification still
involved.
That's
a very small... The testing, those courses, you could have testing and certification, you're absolutely right, but that's a tiny fraction of the cost of education. Would it be worth your running a business? So, well, maybe is that what you're saying? Are you running a certification business is all you're really offering?
Well, what I'm saying is we can supplement, the faculty in India, which is definitely not the caliber of the MIT faculty or the Berkeley faculty.
No problem.
And supplement that with with something that is a branded certification program that meets up to the standards but doesn't really give an MIT degree. You cannot get an MIT degree without going to MIT. So this is kind of like a diploma program, and it's a concentrated, you know, 2-year program as opposed to a 4-year college program, and just teach people
essentials. Doesn't answer the question. The question is, why should you're not adding enough? You're only adding the. You're not even giving them a brand. You're not even giving an MIT degree. All you're giving them is you're certifying that after they've, quote, taken these classes by these open source classes, that you're going to give them a test. And if they pass the test, you're going to give them credit. And if they get enough credits, you're going to give them a degree. Well, that's a technician's job. That's basically, you know, you could create just a bunch of little online tests for each of these courses. And then if they pass the test, you don't even need a person. It's automatically approved. Then when you complete enough units in a different number of categories.
No, I don't think that's what I'm saying, Marty. What I'm saying is that you have to, teaching needs to, I'm trying to add a layer of scalability to the quality of teaching. Today, why is there such a difference between what an MIT engineer is capable of, you know, what an MIT engineer learns versus what, you know, a community college engineer learns? And in India, the situation is really pathetic. You know, there are thousands of quote-unquote engineering colleges where people are learning absolute bullshit.
Not allowed to say that on the radio.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
But that's what's happening. So the point is that you have to somehow or the other raise the quality of the education in a scalable format, and that's the problem that we're trying to solve.
And that leads me to my second concern about your question. First one is, you know, why would anybody pay if they can get this? It's, or they pay anything significant. They'll pay a little for certification, but they're not going to pay a lot
when the course is
available off open source. But the second issue, the larger issue is, you say, why is it that these MIT graduates are much better engineers than those who are in rural India? And you make the assumption that it's because of the quality of the MIT professors. But as you well know, university professors, and the more prestigious the university, the more likely they are to be theoretical, out of touch, arcane, giving lectures that are not likely to be transformative, but are just likely to go in one ear and out the other after the midterm. So isn't it wiser, especially since you're not giving them the brand name of an MIT diploma, wouldn't it be wiser rather to find the finest practitioners in the world, in India and America, etc., pair them up with an interactive video specialist, create custom courses which are not available open source and therefore have a lot more value, and then you're going to have more valuably trained engineers, and that's really scalable because it truly is online and not limited to MIT, and you're not held hostage by MIT and its insistence on their particular lecturer.
So there are several answers to your questions. Let me take them one at a time. First and foremost, that one of the reasons why MIT produces great engineers, and actually India has a bunch of schools that also IIT. Produce great engineers, these are the IITs, is because of their selection system.
Right.
They do a great job in selecting some of the best people. Now, the problem with India is that we have a very large population in India, and the number of people who get admitted to these very few IITs is remarkably small, whereas the volume of talent that is available out there is much larger.
Correct.
The number of people who don't get into IIT or don't get into MIT but are still incredibly smart is very large. And
right.
And the other, if you read Vision India 2020, the MIT India project, the assumption is that this is kind of a corporate training, outsourced corporate training program.
I completely agree that there are many students who could profit from an IIT level education who are not admitted. That justifies indeed the creating of a program.
That's right.
But it does not argue that that needs to be taught by MIT professors.
No, this is not being taught by MIT professors. We are supplementing MIT curriculum. We are making a bunch of faculty follow the MIT curriculum using the open courseware material. Your point about more generating interactive content and delivering education through better quality interactive content, this is a very good idea. This is that is not the premise of the MIT India project necessarily, but I have another project in the book which follows exactly that premise. Is creating custom content. It's called Lucid. It's the second project in Vision India 2020, which addresses K-12 education in that mode.
We'll go there later. The point is,
what I'm saying is that concept of developing interactive content is very well taken. It can be applied to every layer of education. It can be applied to entrepreneurship education. It can be applied to engineering education. It can be applied to medical education. At every level, the concept of interactive education and creating high-powered interactive content for delivering such education, that is also a business opportunity. And that is an opportunity that I strongly recommend the listeners to pursue.
Agree. But you said that the core to this thing was the open source courseware that exists from MIT and other leading research universities. And I'm saying that's shackling you. Because those lectures...
That is one of the ideas in MIT India. That was the assumption because I mitigated the cost. There's in every single Vision India project, I've assumed certain cost structures and what would it take to get it off the ground and so forth. So in developing serious volumes of interactive content, there's a cost to it. And it's quite significant. That cost is significant.
And let's turn to the cost question. And so that, of course, tempts one to want to use the open source content. That's, but I would argue...
That will get you off the ground, right, basically. So one of the things that entrepreneurs need to understand is you have to get yourself off the ground with practical decisions.
But you want to get yourself off the ground not with content that's going to saddle you with ultimate inferiority. Yes, it will give you the cachet of the MIT name or the Berkeley name or the Harvard name on this courseware, but it is going to saddle you with course material that is designed to prepare theoreticians, that is designed by academics.
Yeah, but I think
Let me finish the point. Okay. So it seems to me that rather than, well, of course it's free and it's available, the notion that it's going to be as... I'm going to question your assumption that it necessarily is going to be as costly to develop this interactive content from scratch that is more practically oriented, as you're saying, you're trying to train engineers. I believe that there are many, just as like Wikipedia has created an amazing resource for free, and there's countless numbers of software engineers who contribute to free open source projects creating great software, for example, like Firefox. I think similarly, there are very smart models that could be used to aggregate the wisdom of the greatest practitioners to create amazing courses. And so rather than succumb to, oh, it's free, this professorial developed courses from Berkeley, MIT, Stanford, I would rather either use this kind of crowdsourcing approach or otherwise create interactive video practical courses taught by the greatest created by the greatest practitioners. That's my thought. What's your reaction?
My reaction is that what you're assuming, Wikipedia has been a very long project, and it's these kinds of crowdsourced development is not easy.
True.
And you cannot, again, you know, you cannot base to get to critical mass. You're going to need to get completeness in at least certain areas.
Right.
To be able to run a university, you know, MIT India is a full-fledged engineering university assumption. So I think the point that you're missing is if you can get the MIT brand or a Berkeley brand or a Stanford brand to play with you in this mode, then you can develop all that content as you go along. See, I want to bring you back to the practicality of getting something off the ground. I wrote a piece recently. By the way, I'm not writing for Forbes anymore. I'm completely focused on this 1 million by 1 million project at the moment. We'll talk about that later. But one of the pieces that I wrote for Forbes, probably in the last few months, one of the most controversial pieces that I've written for Forbes is, are business schools setting up entrepreneurs for failure? And I raised this question, is that business schools are teaching entrepreneurs how to go out and raise money. Well, you know, you don't raise money until you've got your venture off the ground. We are in a, you know, post-financial crisis. We are in a market where it's excruciatingly difficult to fund any idea. Concept stage financing has all but gone out of the window. You know, people are very, very risk averse. Venture capitalists pretend they're doing Series A financing, but what they're really doing is Series B financing. They expect Series A, all the risks of Series A, to be either taken by the entrepreneur through bootstrapping or by some, you know, drip financing angel investor or something. But the real venture capital doesn't touch deals until much later.
True.
So now this is why you, all entrepreneurs, as you're looking at business ideas, you have to keep in mind, how do you get your project off the ground and how you keep your initial cost structure low?
Right. And the way I would, I didn't mean to imply that my course development would be done a la, so slowly in accretion like with like Wikipedia. I'd like to run down, in light of our conversation, it's not like I'm blowing off, I agree with much of what you're saying, but there is much that I would improve in it, in my judgment, and then I'm going to give you the
Absolutely.
Last word.
Absolutely.
So here is my model, uh-huh. and then I'm going to give you the last word, then we're going to move to another topic. So if I were starting this online, scalable university for, let's just say engineers, as you said, what I would do is I would identify the courses. I would assemble a small team of three or four of the major employers of engineers. And I'd probably start with software engineering since that it tends to be such a growing area. And I would assemble those three people and we would say, we're going to create the dream list of courses. That's going to be, that is not going to be the general, the liberal arts stuff that people can get locally, et cetera. But we're talking about 2 years worth of material that would render people an amazingly productive an intelligent and perhaps even intrapreneurial software engineer. And I would create the course titles and the content, the overall, the main topics in each of those courses. And for then each of those courses, I would not wait for thousands of, I would identify three or four of the best practitioners in each of those areas for that course.
Mm-hmm.
I would pair them with an interactive video specialist. And for each of those, I would create a simulation-based course where we would take the three or five, let's say it was a course in, what's a topic in software engineering? Any topic?
Right now, Ruby on Rails.
Okay. So we would take Ruby on Rails is a software. Yeah. We would take a practical real-world problem that could be beautifully solved with Ruby on Rails. And we would take that problem and have these three professors and the interactive instructor, they would come up with a clever way to teach Ruby on Rails that way. And they would be getting shares. It would be like any other startup. These professors would get every time there was a click through of somebody using this taking this course, the professors would get money. That way, I don't need to have any major investment. It's not like MIT is giving me their brand anyway. They're saying, you're not letting you call this an MIT diploma.
Getting an MIT brand is extremely difficult.
Right, so that
topic is dealt with extensively in the book. So let me just frame this for you.
Yes.
This book is designed to trigger exactly these kinds of discussions and these kinds of thought in each one of you, and you don't need to necessarily build a billion-dollar business. The idea of doing a Ruby on Rails specific interactive curriculum that you build a $2 million business on is just fine. Go for it. You know, there are in every single one of these $45 billion ideas that is part of Vision India 2020, there are, you know, hundreds and thousands of small business ideas that you can derive. And that is manageable, that is easy to bootstrap, that is, you know, leverageable based on your particular skill set. So go for it. Look at these ideas. See what triggers. See what takes advantage of your skill set and your particular assets and build on it. And that's just fine. You don't need to build a billion-dollar company.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Sramana Mitra. She is the author of three books, including Vision India 2020, in which she proposes a number of cool vision business ideas that are useful, especially for India, but are certainly generalizable in many ways to here. Because you asked me to ask you about this, and I will, before we go back to talk about some of these other ideas that we're going to kick back and forth, you raised the excellent point in the coffee room as we were having coffee that the missing ingredient in America is taking, and the worldwide, is that the vast middle of people are not trained to be entrepreneurs. Why is that important, and what is your solution?
So let me start by saying that I am a firm believer in capitalism. In the first time I came here on your show, this is my third appearance on your show, but the first time I came here, I remember we had this discussion and I drove home the point that I still believe in capitalism. And this, I think, was, you know, maybe right after the financial crisis had hit the market and we were still kind of reeling from it. Today, I will tell you, you know, my thinking has matured on that topic. And I think one of the problems we have in capitalism today is that the speculators have hijacked the system. So we have a vastly stratified capitalism where the vast majority of the world population is not able to benefit from capitalism. Capitalism is in the hands of a very, very small number of people. It's kind of like fortune at the top of the pyramid, with the speculators running the show in a very big way, and that is deeply disturbing to me. So I believe that if we could make entrepreneurship education, since we're on the topic of education, if we could take entrepreneurship education and spread it out and really educate millions of people around the world in the basics of entrepreneurship. And I frankly understand Silicon Valley entrepreneurship deeply. I understand what works. I understand what doesn't work. I understand what needs to be taught to this vast middle. It is not necessarily venture capital. It is the art of bootstrapping. It is the art of, you know, little nuances like inventory financing, receivables financing, you know, customer validation, validation methodology. There's a variety of different things that I'm teaching in a project that I'm doing called 1 million by 1 million.
By the way, these are jargon terms. You know, bootstrapping is merely coming up with your own money for the project rather than borrowing. This is not like anything fancy. You know, receivable financing is getting somebody to borrow you some money in case there's money that's owed you and you're not getting the companies who are owing you or the people who are paying you are not paying you yet. You need to be able to pay your bills or borrowing some money short term.
Right.
Okay.
So yes, these are jargon, but these are some of the principles
important.
That
Absolutely.
You need to understand
yes.
quite deeply in being able to leverage them to your advantage. So my point is, if you are, if you are thinking about entrepreneurship even remotely, I believe that you can learn very easily, actually quite easily, the basics of entrepreneurship, the basics of what makes a successful entrepreneur. And I have created this program called 1 Million by 1 Million. The mission is to help a million entrepreneurs reach $1 million in annual revenue, thereby creating $1 trillion of global GDP and 10 million jobs by 2020. And wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever be your level of expertise at this point, I strongly encourage you, follow this program. I have actually written 5 books in the last 2 years, and part of that is the 4-book Entrepreneur Journey series that documents a large part of it, and I do an online reality show mode roundtable, strategy roundtable every week. You can use this book series and the methodology that I'm teaching to get yourself up to speed. This is a really, really important discipline that you can learn and you can leverage to become a successful mid-level entrepreneur.
And I want to agree with your goal and disagree with your methods.
Mm-hmm.
Your goal is fantastic. I think we do need to create a world of ethical entrepreneurs who can do small business even simpler than you describe, because, you know, borrowing off of your receivables, that ends up already, that suggests a level of complexity beyond many people can. And so what I would argue is that the best way to do that is, and I hate to be repetitive, but to come up with, instead of a book, but to create real world simulations of businesses. Now, this is some business problems, a simple business. Like, you came up with an idea for a candy store. What are you going to do to take this idea for a candy store and vet it? How are you going to find out if it's a good idea? How are you going to decide out whether it's going to be done online or with a storefront? How are you going to design which candies? How are you going to decide where you're going to get your initial financing? How are you going to decide how are you going to attract customers? How are you going to use publicity? How are you going to do signage? How are you going to be customer relations? How are you going to price? But by doing it that way with these interactive models and then having world-class entrepreneurs, good entrepreneurs. You don't need world-class. A good entrepreneur give you feedback in these simulations. No, you made a mistake. You should not use your signage this way. No, you shouldn't borrow money for this. You should be doing it this way. It seems to me that that is the model, and it's scalable if it's done online and with simulations. Do you agree or disagree?
The 1 million by 1 million project has a very ambitious program. It's got a tremendous both curriculum, and it's a completely case study-based teaching methodology which addresses the kinds of things you're talking about. I have the best, over the last 5 years of my work, I have developed the best collection of case studies as far as early-stage entrepreneurship is concerned or in the world. I would say I have better case studies than MIT or Stanford.
Right. Are they too complicated for the average person rather than we're looking at our target population?
Not necessarily. I'll give you an example. I have an entrepreneur whom I have studied in that mode, and the case study is available. He's built a company called Blinds.com. It's a $50 million company selling window blinds online. So why do I bring this company up? This is a very normal person, a very, very normal, average human being who started off by selling window blinds door to door. And then by putting one foot before the other, he has gradually scaled his business. He has leveraged the potential of e-commerce. And he has built a company that has $50 million of revenue a year, which is a very, very, you know, sustainable revenue level.
I think there are many people who don't care or want to have $50 million in revenue. And many, if the goal is to create $70,000 a year in net profit in a simple business run by one person, perhaps with one assistant,
etc. Okay, let me give you a few more examples like that.
Yeah, because that I think then that becomes accessible to the world.
Exactly. I have an entrepreneur who came to one of my roundtables, the 1 million roundtable. By the way, any of you are welcome to come. You can go to sramanamitra.com, sramanamitra.com, and you hit on the roundtable button. On the top right corner, you can register for it. As many of you want to attend, you're very welcome to attend. So let me give you an example of an entrepreneur of the kind that Marty is talking about. This is an entrepreneur who is doing a company called Artemis Art. She is doing it from her home. She has bought a scanner.
Right, $100, no big deal, $200.
Yeah, is maybe a little bit more.
Okay.
Maybe whatever. A $700 scanner,
fine.
A high-end scanner.
Very
okay?
good, sure.
And her premise is that there are lots of moms who... you know, really love their children. Moms generally love their children, but these moms really love their children, and they have accumulated shoeboxes full of children's art.
Sure.
Collected over, you know, 7, 10, 12, whatever number of years.
I believe it. And papers and things, all kinds of stuff.
Kids so she's work. Asking these moms to send them these shoeboxes full of stuff.
Like
she
it.
Scans all of these and turns them
Got
into
it.
A museum quality book.
Got it.
The book costs $250.
Sorry.
And she ships the book back, however many copies of it you want, and a shoebox full of art that came
like
to
it.
Her, send it back to the mom. Now, I asked her, you know, $250 is an expensive book. And she says, that's okay. I don't want to build a big business. I just want to build high quality books for these moms. And I said, that is fine. I'm delighted to support you in this mission. You build a small business that you have full control over and you make a good livelihood out of it. This is a type of entrepreneurship that I'm very, very supportive of.
And I agree. I like it. Even broader, I'm always thinking about, you're talking about scalability. I would love to create something for the masses. One of Marty Nemko's most deeply held beliefs about entrepreneurship is that your risk increases exponentially when you try to innovate. Because if it's a brand new idea that is not thought of by somebody else, there is a great chance that in the rest of the world, it's been tried many times and failed. It could succeed, but it also could take so long, even if it's a great idea. So long to get the word out, to get enough people to buy it, that you're out of business cash flow wise before that. I believe you should not innovate. Small businesses should not innovate. They should replicate. They should find an existing business that is very successful. The example I use all the time are burrito places. Places that are very busy, places that sell a lot of burritos, you have an infinitely greater chance of success. If you find the five busiest burrito places, you go and hang out there and you take their very best ideas of menu selection, ergonomics, recipe, everything, and you combine them into your own burrito place in the perfect location, your chances of success are infinitely higher than if you innovate.
Well, I think you're right. Innovation is hard and the risks of innovation are significant. So, but innovation, you know, as far as I'm concerned, innovation happens at different scales and at different levels. So another example, I have a company that came to one of my 1 million by 1 million roundtables. That is an entrepreneur out of New Jersey that is selling $700,000 worth of wedding runners online. This is an e-commerce business, an extremely competent entrepreneur. Now, what is the insight that allowed her to build the $700,000 a year business-to-business company? This is not a B2C company.
What B2C means business to consumer, okay?
Right. Yep. What she realized was that wedding runners tend to be slippery fabric. And since brides and bridesmaids who walk on these on the aisle tend to wear tall heels, they tend to slip. So she came up with a non-slippery custom-designed wedding runner, and she's selling to wedding planners all over the country, and some in Europe as well. So this is a an example of an innovation that is a manageable, you know, subtle innovation, but it's a little understanding, little subtle understanding that allows her to address a problem and solve a problem. Solving a problem allows you to build a great company.
I like it, but think about the risks associated with that. She won, and she's making $700,000 a year. But they've been making wedding runners for decades or 100 years. For me, if I'm teaching entrepreneurship, and I use that as an inspirational example, the odds are that somebody else will have created one, or my formula doesn't really work, or it falls apart, or it costs too much to create, or somebody else steals the idea, much safer in general. Not if I'm trying to change the world, but if I'm trying to make an honorable living for myself and my family, to simply take a standard good business, whether it be an espresso cart, or it be a dry cleaning business, or it be a janitorial service, and simply merge the best features of those without requiring the incredible risk of innovation. Do you not agree?
Yeah, this is why franchises are so successful, right? Franchise has been one of the greatest models of business creation and cookie cuttering a successful business model. This is why if you read Vision India 2020, there's a number of micro franchise kinds of business ideas in it. You know, I have ideas that are related to flower farms, that are related to all sorts of things which leverage the idea of micro franchise. So I think franchise is good. The other thing that you can look at is value-added resellers, right? There are lots of companies that are building products that need customer support, that need technical support, or that need system integration. So you can build on somebody else who's investing $100 million in building a major product. Like I saw a company on Friday, a company came to see me. This is a company that had this idea of doing a next generation firewall. Firewall is a security product. It's a computer security product. And these guys took about $9.4 million in Series A financing in 2007, I think. And today they're already a $100 million company. The company is largely sold by value-added resellers who can go and sell the company, implement the product, you know, do troubleshooting, whatever. It's the feet on the street customer service. Value-added reseller is a very good business model for small-time entrepreneurship.
As you said, a lot of companies, however, cannot get $9.2 million in Series A financing.
Exactly. Value-added resellers don't need that. If you are riding on top of somebody else's innovation, let somebody else take the risk of the innovation. You do the customer support and the technical support and the system integration. That's not a very risky business.
Good. I agree with you about the notion, of course, of replication. I think franchises it's a great idea for the innovator. It's a terrible idea for the person who wants to copy the idea. I'll tell you why. Most franchisors are not benevolent people. They end up charging a fortune in fees to start and then a big percentage of the profits. If I wanted to replicate, I would avoid the franchisors like crazy. That's just paying him for not. What I would do is I would find an individual who's running the successful business. That's why I like retail businesses, because you can go and you can see them succeed. Some business to business that's hiding in the ninth floor of some big office building, you don't know what they're doing. But if you see people out the door in some retail business, I go and then I will hire him as a consultant. And very often they're flattered. As long as I sign an agreement, I'm not going to open within a geographic area where you are. And I will either. Sometimes you can get him to do it for free.
You're making an assumption that you have money to hire a consultant. Consultants cost a lot of money.
But franchise costs much more.
Your point is well taken. I think there are pros and cons to franchises. The pro to franchise is somebody else is doing the brand marketing for you. So that is the pro to franchises. Now, the con to franchises, that is what you're talking about. There are fees involved. But at the same time, there are also opportunities in replicating ideas. Like, you know, I talked about Mayfield Bakery when we came in.
Right.
You asked me what did I have for breakfast.
Your walnut cranberry bread.
I talked about a walnut cranberry bread. That's a damn good bread. Now, Mayfield Bakery in Town and Country Village in Palo Alto is a booming small business. Why? Because they produce excellent bakery products.
Excellent. It's a great example.
Right? So if you do anything, do an excellent job of it. Do something simple. Make chocolates.
You've just made my point. There is a bread chain called Panera.
Yes.
And Panera charges $200,000 in fees to start you up. If instead I go to Mayfield Bakery's owner and I say, wow, your stuff is great, I'll pay you. First of all, I'd get, would you allow me? I will sign an agreement to say I will not open within 20 miles of where you are. Would you be willing to, I will pay you $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000 if you like,
yeah,
to teach me. So I'm paying a tiny fraction of the cost to create a not cookie cutter, but a one of a kind fantastic business. Am I not better hiring that person at Mayfield than Panera?
These are all great business ideas. And part of it is you need the recipe, right? Like we're going to go to an Indian restaurant right after this
Pakwan,
show,
yes,
called Pakwan. And Pakwan has created, I think, 3 or 4 restaurants already,
yep,
in the Bay Area.
Yep.
These guys have a fantastic recipe.
Yeah.
You know, the formula is great.
I can't wait to go. You told me about this thing, yeah?
So I'm waiting for a Pakwan to open up in Redwood City or Palo Alto, where we're closer to where I live, but there is none. Well, if somebody is listening out there, if you have any idea about Indian cooking, well, go open a Pakwan restaurant or Pakwan style restaurant.
Great.
In the peninsula.
So this is a wonderful idea. Now, this is, again, this replication. What if I said, Sramana, you have all these people coming to your round table to learn about entrepreneurship. Why don't you spend 1 or 2 hours with a protege, one of the people who's attended this million-by-million round table? Because I know you don't want to start a restaurant. But you find this person, you tell him, this is gold. And then you go with that person to the owner of Pakwan, and you say, I would like to open one in Redwood City. Here's the business plan. Here's how it would work. Now, would that not be a smarter way for your protege to replicate this great concept at minimal cost? You'll make a few bucks, too, as
that
the
deal. That is not scalable.
So what?
I am actually...
My point.
I have very serious plans for 1 million by 1 million market.
Okay.
I am actually going to scale this.
Good.
And it's a major technology plan. It's a major curriculum plan. It is also... taking ideas like that, taking, you know, some powerful ideas and making a number of entrepreneurs execute on it in different geographical areas, all of that is part of the plan. But you have to give me time to build this up because it is a very ambitious project. And this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. So
you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Sramana Mitra. She is the author of a number of books, but I think the way I want to describe her is, she's somebody who is technically excellent. She's got a master's in MIT, but knows she doesn't want to spend her life in front of a bench. She likes to write also. She's more verbal than the average, and she's in some ways practically smarter, although I think she's been spending too much time among rarefied smart people, and I think if she's trying to create this really scalable entrepreneurship education thing, she's got to spend more time talking to more average people and create simpler business. But I think she is one of the smarter potential entrepreneurship educators around. Is that a fair description of you?
Sure.
Okay, including the negative. It's unlike the usual.
You're absolutely right. You know, when I left MIT, one of my friends told me that, well, you're stepping out into a world where the average IQ is going to drop significantly. Mm-hmm. And I accepted that. But then Silicon Valley is another very high average IQ area, and I do have access to the highest level of Silicon Valley. So yes, but you could say that my thinking was significantly skewed in that direction. But with 1 million by 1 million, I have the kinds of businesses you hear me describing today, wedding runners and so forth, these are not Silicon Valley businesses.
Right.
You know, Shoebox, Children's Art, these are not Silicon Valley businesses.
Let's talk about, as we said, the book Vision India 2020 fascinated me particularly because she came up with 45 ideas that were made for India but are very much generalizable.
It's a development economics book. You can apply it to any place, basically.
Right. So let's talk about there's some of these other businesses you came up with. And again, I think it's instructive for our listeners to hear the way two entrepreneurial minds go and try to massage a business idea. So let's talk about Maya Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly describe Maya Ray first. And again, we'll go back and forth and try to make it better and better and better.
So Maya Ray comes out of my conclusion about India, particularly in general, but it is a very, very general idea in that this whole notion of business process outsourcing, which is a very large industry, needs to leverage the rural talent.
Let me describe what business process outsourcing is.
Sure.
This is whether every company of any size has human resources, customer service, outsourcing, billing, All of those kind of services are need to be done. Legal, tremendous niche in legal. There's a tremendous amount of back office work and even front office work, customer service, but back office work that needs to be done in legal and medical and all these different niches. And companies are very much moving to having these things outsourced because it can be done so much less expensively, and much of the work product is done online. Yeah. Continue.
And what happened in India in this whole, you know, especially in the last decade or more than a decade, when once the internet became, broadband internet became a reality, it was easy for U.S. companies and European companies to outsource work to India and Philippines and Eastern Europe and so forth. And that's how the business process industry, outsourcing industry became highly globalized. Now, the costs have risen greatly in India.
I know, at least in the urban areas.
In urban area in India, Bangalore, Bombay, real estate is
Delhi.
Very, very, very expensive.
How about Calcutta?
Calcutta is less so, but but still, I mean, you know, so there is, my point is, India is not Bangalore. India is not Delhi.
That's right.
India is a very large country
of
billion people. And you have all these, you know, small towns.
Right.
Forget even rural India. The small towns where you can create companies which still gives you a cost structure that is dramatically lower than the cost structure that you're facing in urban India.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole premise of my array, is that you can take work from, you know, high-cost areas and get that work done in rural India, and that plays a development economics role. And that same theory applies to America as well, by the way. Think about it. Why are people in Bangalore answering calls for American customers? Why aren't people in Montana and Idaho answering those calls? There are a variety of reasons. Of course, the tax structure is screwed up and blah, 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 which makes the minimum wage and so forth, which creates barriers for job creation in rural America, which is why India is benefiting and the Philippines is benefiting. But these things need to be addressed.
Yeah. Here are some of the questions and the problems. I mean, obviously, America is doing a fair amount of what they call near sourcing. So there are companies, for example, who you know, are based in Silicon Valley and in Bakersfield, where the cost structure is low in California,
yes,
or in Arizona or New Mexico. But here is the problem. Especially when you're dealing with the fairly technical work that's required, in rural India, more than even in, you know, rural Arkansas, you've got problems. First of all, no English, much less English skills. You've got much less computer expertise. They're generally far less educated. To the extent to which you've got to get a manager to come out to live in rural India, it's going to be harder to do that. So when you add up all of those costs and difficulties, on a psychological basis, it feels egalitarian to spread the wealth from Bangalore, Delhi, et cetera, to West Bengal. It creates maybe more problems than it would solve.
So one kind of job that is not going to go to rural India is call center jobs, because the English is really a barrier. And that level of spoken English just doesn't exist in rural India, and it never will exist in rural India. So that is why I think actually America should take back its call center jobs from India. This is a real opportunity because the cost structure is changing in India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, why wouldn't they go to another lower cost country?
They are going.
They're
going to
go to Pakistan and other countries
where
the cost is.
Same problem. You have this English problem. The English problem exists in droves in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
This is an opportunity for America.
I agree with you. So
right?
In other words, yes, near-shoring to low-cost
America. However, there is a part, there's a style of jobs that don't require any spoken English. That is pure back-office jobs. And Indian, even in the small-town India, spoken English may be a problem. Written English or understanding English is not a problem.
I didn't know that.
Right? There are lots of people who understand English, who study English, and there are lots of jobs that are, you know, like I have been talking to the people who have started doing some rural India outsourcing. Sridhar Mitta, who was one of the founders of Wipro.
Mm-hmm. Wipro is one of the major outsourcing firms.
Major outsourcing firms. Dr. Mitta has started, you know, leading a rural BPO effort. And what he is doing is, you know, there's a lot of digitization work. You know, just taking paper and digitizing that paper. This doesn't require anything.
So there
very
have,
rural India-friendly jobs.
So now we get to this question. I mean, you know, believe it or not, outsourcing is becoming a mature industry. So Infosys and Wipro and Tata have been been doing outsourcing now for over a decade. If it was such a brilliant idea to move some of that digitally centric work to rural India, why have they not done
it? They are doing it. So
is there really an opportunity there?
The Infosys, Wipro are they don't do this very low end work because this is like totally cost game. There are smaller outsourcers that are doing it, and again, it's innovation, right? This is a style of innovation. It has infrastructure barriers. It has all sorts of training requirements and so on and so forth. So a lot of times, things that are slightly difficult to do are done by entrepreneurs, and the model gets proven, and then the larger companies go. Satyam, by the way, which got into huge trouble, has started trying to do some of this stuff.
Let's turn to another example. It's kind of more visual. We all know that water is an issue in many areas. I don't know, is water shortage an issue in India?
It's a huge issue.
That's
not only not
quality
only that
of water, right?
Not only that, there is a I don't know how much you follow what's going on between India, China, India, Pakistan. There are massive political and diplomatic problems brewing. So the source of all the North Indian rivers that serve most of Indian population
Ganges
from a water
river,
point
right.
of view, Ganges, Brahmaputra,
right.
these are rivers, their origin is in Tibet.
Uh-huh.
Which, why do you think China is so
wow.
keen on controlling Tibet?
Wow, that would sort the
This is going to be,
the
be the Third World War.
That would
They're
going to
shut off the
faucet to Indian water. Oh, my
They're
God.
They're trying to dam that. And so this is a world
wow.
war in the making.
Wow. So, okay, so that really, so there's no question there's a need for water desalinization. No question.
And so the solution to that is India has a huge coastline.
Right.
Right? India is a peninsula. Most of India is a peninsula. So you have enormous amount of coastline. So the solution to that is putting desalination parts all over the coastline of India so
Great.
That the water shortage can be mitigated.
The
Same thing with
huge.
America again.
The need is huge. And yeah, even in Southern and Northern California, it's an issue. And certainly Israel has been on the forefront of desalinization.
Australia? Yeah. Very big.
Right, big coastline. So great. So there's no question. I do not have any pushback on the need. The need is huge. Now, as usual, I understand that the costs basically now are 50 cents per cubic foot for desalinization. My question is, before you go and establish these plants, we are in an energy, a global, we are in the world where we genuflect before green and energy conservation. The cost of, the energy cost of desalinization is huge. Is that not a prohibitive factor?
There's technology that is coming. The technology that I've used in the two projects, there are two water desalination projects that I developed in Vision India 2020, and the technology assumption in that is a technology from a company here in San Leandro called Energy Recovery Incorporated that Dominic is on the board of. This is a company that has been able to cut down that cost significantly. So I can't say that, you know, water desalination.
I didn't say cost. I said energy.
Energy
usage.
Cost. This is energy recovery, and the cost of desalination is on energy cost. So this is an energy that gets recycled.
Okay.
In the process. You're exactly right. Energy cost is the issue with the desalination cost.
To what extent, but transportation is another cost. Because it's all well and good. You know, water is very heavy. So it's all well and good to go, even if you do cogeneration and you have, you know, some other, you tie it into some other energy source, like a nuclear power plant, which generates a lot of heat, and you take the effluent heat from the nuclear power plant and you go and you use it to provide the energy for the desalinization plant. Now you got water locally in some, you know, right on the coast, but
yeah.
most of India and is inland, and not to mention
channels,
Australia.
Right, but it's a very large riverine country. India is full of rivers. The problem is the rivers are drying up. Because if, you know, the glaciers are melting and, you know, then if we have this political problem, this diplomatic problem with China at some point, all these rivers are going to dry up. But the canals through which water passes, that exists. So if you dredge those canals, some of the problems is the dredging infrastructure
canals,
is a problem.
Yeah.
You need to dredge the canals, and you have to
canals,
you
yeah.
know you have yes you have to make sure that the canals flow well, and then you can use those canals to transport water. Mm.
So you would you I'm just making this up as I go along. Is it too expensive to somehow line those canals? Because they're not, obviously they're filled with dirt and all kinds of, there's been so much pollution
silt.
Thrown into those
there's
waters.
There's been a lot of silt. You know,
right.
Rivers silt up. That is just the way rivers operate. You know, I know all this because my father is a shipping guy,
But silt is one thing. The point is, because of the lack of sanitation in India, the waters have
been
used.
That is a different issue. That's a whole different issue.
So that's what I'm saying. You can't take the desalinized water and put it into these canal beds that have been so much.
India has massive infrastructure problems. India has to invest. The infrastructure investment that China is making very systematically, India needs to make that investment. And there's no going around that. America needs to make that investment as well, because the water problem exists in America as well, and it will escalate in America as well.
Dear listeners, what are we doing here? We are here in California. We're not here to be talking about solving India's water problem. But what we're trying to do is, we are two entrepreneurial people, Sramana Mitra and I. We think entrepreneurially, and rather than preach about how to be an entrepreneur, we are taking problems. We're identifying problems. We're brainstorming how to address them. This is not happy talk radio where you have nice little pat solutions. We are grappling with these hard things to teach you what it takes to really be an entrepreneur in terms of the problem identification, in terms of the problem solution, the financing, etc. And that's why we're doing this. Is that a fair summary of what we're up
Absolutely.
To here?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, one thing that you may want to look at, listeners, is that the Obama administration is actually trying to move money into the infrastructure world in a somewhat strategic way. They want to fund projects that solve clean energy issues and clean tech issues. So there's actually a tremendous amount of small business research funding that is available in these pools that you could potentially go after. Let's say you want to set up a water desalination plant in the coast of California. You could look at tapping into some of these kinds of funding, because I know people are getting funding.
No question. And do you have any specifics on that?
I spoke with the guy from SBA recently, who's working on this, jump-starting more of fostering more of the innovation ecosystem, and he kind of gave me a breakdown of like 18 agencies in the SBA that are getting most of these funds, are deploying most of these funds.
Do you want to post that on your blog? That would be useful for a lot of people and drive
yes.
traffic to your blog. What's your good to, and they can get to your blog from sramanamitra.com.
Yeah, so just get to my blog and we'll
sramanamitra.com.
Right.
Okay. Why don't we have a few minutes left? Let's have fun. We've been talking about some of the big problems, you know, education and rural problems and water. Let's play. One of your ideas in the book Vision India 2020 is to try to bring California wine to India. I'm going to leave aside the tango part for a minute, you know, but that's a fascinating concept, because I have, you know, at least the Indians I know in America are extremely status conscious. They are brand conscious to the maximum. And so to take California wines and bring them to India makes a lot of sense. That's one of your ideas. Now, to what extent already are designer label or even mid-label California wines in India, at least in the major cities?
So the Indian consumer, you can imagine when a billion consumer, you know, billion people population wakes up to consumerism, that creates opportunities, right? And we have two geographies like that. We have China and India waking up to consumerism. And these are geographies that traditionally were not wine-drinking countries.
Right.
And they're now learning to drink wine. And you're right, it's the rich and it's the status-conscious, affluent classes that are learning to drink wine, which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's harmless. It's a harmless way to spend money. You
it's
know.
A very harmless way to spend money.
Within reason, unless you're drinking a bottle of that stuff at a time. But anyway, yes.
Even with a bottle is okay. I think
For one person?
If you drink four bottles, that's a problem.
Oh, wow, okay.
But if you but it's these are populations that need to be taught how to appreciate wine. They really don't understand wine. I mean, until a few years ago, the wine that was being sold in India, especially the Indian wine, was really bad. And I have a reasonably sophisticated palate for wine, so it was absolutely excruciating, painful.
You know, I get one
but.
Minute. I know, I got it. But what I'm not understanding is, I mean, I have a home in Napa, and so I have been drinking Napa wine. I'm trying to, quote, educate myself. I mean, I work awfully hard. Why do I have to educate myself? Why don't I have to just drink something that tastes good? Why do I have to really work to see if I can tell the top notes of tobacco and the mid notes of lemongrass and all this other crap?
You don't have, all you need is decent wine at a decent price.
Right.
You know?
I agree with
you.
So
what is not going to work
Two
very
buck
well...
Chuck.
What, $2
Which is great, by the way. It great. Don't laugh. It is great. They buy, you know, they buy all the great, where there's, we have a wine lake in California because all these vanity rich people who've made millions in Silicon Valley open up wineries, vineyards.
And they need to sell their grapes.
They need to sell their stuff. So you can, you know, and that's what Two Buck Chuck is.
Yes.
It's great stuff. We don't need to spend money to have good wine. Continue.
So, but in India, I think what will work is more the $10, $12, $15, $20 bottles of wine. It is not going to be the $50, $60, $80 bottles
of wine.
Why
not the $6 and $5 and
$4
bottles of wine?
Maybe $4, $5 bottles of wine. So the point is, there is actually an opportunity for California to open up a huge, huge export market.
Correct.
Working with India, working with China.
Can we do it small? Remember, I'm always thinking about what is realistic for most people. Let's create, right now in these last couple of minutes, let's create a simple model.
Yep.
For how somebody who wants to make $70,000 a year exporting California wine to one city or one thing in India, how would you do it so that it was easily doable?
You find a partner in India. You find basically an export-import partner in India. You find a wine store. You know, you find
good.
You become the merchandiser. If you have any idea about what wine is and how wine gets to market, you go develop relationships with a bunch of wineries or distributors in California.
Too much.
And
I'm going to tell you my version. Here's my version.
Okay, that's
a bunch. I don't need a bunch. I want to buy some of that excess wine. And I'm going to brand it. I know that India is extreme. They hate America and they love America. But they love American brands. I would call my wine Harvard Crimson. You know the Harvard Crimson, right? I would call my red wine the Harvard Crimson. And I would buy it for probably 20 cents, you know, a fifth. Because you've got all this wine. It can be good. It needs to be good. It needs to be easy drinking. Smooth.
I completely disagree with you. Because what you're proposing is far more complex than what I'm proposing.
Okay, I'll listen
because
to you.
Because making wine is complex.
Not making. I'm buying the already made wine. Already made wine. The stuff that's already been made and is sitting in the vats.
Even that is complex. The bottling and the marketing and all of that is complex. I'm saying simply buy wine that has been branded and marketed.
Okay.
And just do export-import. It is very simple. Just sell, buy from the California producers and sell it to the Indian retailers. That's all you do.
What would be the one retail you'd go after that would be the easiest and smartest way?
I have no idea.
But if you made one trip to Bangalore,
yeah,
you
go look
out.
Up. Go look up. You just go take a tour in Bangalore, take a tour in Bombay, take a tour in Delhi and find the wine stores and just go talk to them.
And it was a pleasure, as usual, talking with you, Sramana Mitra.
Likewise.
Again, the website, she's filled with ideas. She's a clever woman. I find her fun. Go to one of her million-by-million forums or whatever. You have a great way to access her. She's great. She's fun. I love her. Sramana Mitra, SramanaMitra.com. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy. And, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. My wife, Dr. Barbara Nemco, and I are going to talk with about a book that is I'm going to tell you about this guy. His name is Robert Cialdini. He is probably the key member of President Obama's messaging team, or depending on your politics, manipulation team, whatever you want to call it. But his book called Influence is considered one of the most sophisticated books ever written on how to influence opinions. Incredibly valuable. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
More than 500 of Marty Nemco's published articles and chapters from his book, Cool Careers for Dummies, are free on his website. From there, you can also email him if you'd like coaching on your career or want to comment on this program. His site, martynemco.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco right here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.